Programming we have more music for you to enjoy. From our studios in Havana, Cuba, I'm Isabel Garcia.
Vuela desde el Caribe un verso ángel colibrí, una corriente incontenible. Vuela hasta una ceiba, posa en mi techo ese mirar y se abalanza hasta llenarme el pecho.
¿Qué sería la vida sin las mujeres, sin los amores? ¿Qué sería la vida sin la salud y sin los temores? ¿Qué sería la vida sin el peligro de no vivirla? ¿Qué sería la vida si tú no puedes compartirla?
Lo que quiero es que me dejen vivir en paz.
Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Havana, Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
An alternative shortwave radio station covering Cuba and the world.
Radio Havana, Cuba, 45 years on the air.
Always with you, wherever you may be. Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas. Welcome to Radio Havana, Cuba, this Monday, December 18th. I'm Isabel Garcia, inviting our listeners to one full hour of alternative information right from the source. We will begin tonight's programming with our editorial viewpoint. We then have Olga Maria Rodriguez with a report on the five Cuban political prisoners incarcerated in the United States. Then we have Ceci Spresno with our Latin American roundup. Yobar Hernandez back with us after a vacation, and he has the world of sports. And then ending our first hour, we have Jorge Millares and the Caribbean Outlook Show. But first, we will switch over to the newsroom with Ed Newman.
Hey, good evening from Radio Havana, Cuba's news desk. I'm Ed Newman. Here are this evening's headlines. Military options sought for up to 50,000 more troops in Iraq. Iraqi government troops burst into Red Crescent offices and kidnapped 30. And the White House wants to protect Vice President Dick Cheney. Military planners at the Pentagon and White House budget analysts have been asked to provide President George W. Bush with options for increasing U.S. forces in Iraq by some 50,000. The request indicates that the option of a major so-called surge in troop strength is gaining ground as part of a White House strategy review, according to administration officials. Discussion of increasing the number of U.S. troops, at least temporarily, has coursed through Washington for the past several months as a possible way to reverse the deteriorating security situation in Baghdad. But the decision to ask the Joint Chiefs of Staff to specify where the additional forces could be found among overstretched Army, Marine, and National Guard units and to seek a cost estimate from the White House Budget Office may mean a turn in the debate, according to sources on Capitol Hill. Officials said that the options being considered include the deployment of upwards of 50,000 additional troops, but that the political, training, and recruiting obstacles to an increase larger than 20 to 30,000 troops would be prohibitive. At present, only about 17,000 U.S. soldiers are actively involved in patrolling and occupied Baghdad, so even the low end of the proposals being adopted by military and budget officials, or being considered rather, would more than double the size of that force. If adopted, such an increase would be a major departure from the current strategy advocated by General George W. Casey, Jr., which has stressed stepping up the training of Iraqi forces and handing responsibility to them as quickly as possible. The details of the plan under study by the White House are not known, but in most scenarios, the troop increase would be accomplished in large part by accelerating some scheduled deployments while delaying the departure of units in Iraq. According to White House spokesman, the U.S. President has made no final decision. Gordon Jandrow, the National Security Council spokesman, said that no memorandums outlining the options for increasing troop strength had gone to the President. But one senior official at the White House said the subject was discussed at length one day last week during Bush's briefing at the Pentagon, and that the president has reportedly asked for detailed questions that some officials have interpreted as suggesting that he is strongly leaning in that direction. U.S. military officials have said that the Pentagon was planning to send the 2nd Brigade of the 82nd Airborne Division to Kuwait next month in January. The brigade, based at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, would serve as a reserve that commanders in Iraq could draw on. American military commanders have been operating without such a reserve since the Marine unit that had been on call was dispatched to Anbar Province in western Iraq. The Army Brigade would become an element of troop deployment to Iraq if the White House decided to increase troops there. That option has apparently been central to a broader debate in Washington. Advocates of a troop increase say the aim would be to reverse the slide toward what is now being called an all-out civil war. But critics of an increase in troop strength have argued that any increase would lead to more American casualties and merely put off the day when the Iraqis need to assume responsibility for their own security. Senator John McCain, the right-wing Republican senator from Arizona and a certain presidential candidate for the GOP in 2008, said during a visit to Baghdad last week that American military commanders were discussing the possibility of adding as many more as 10 combat brigades, about 35,000 troops. McCain supports calling up more occupation troops to Iraq. And according to a story in the Washington Post over the weekend, two retired Army veterans who served in the unit that took control of the northern Iraqi city of Tal Afar in 2005, Colonel Joel Armstrong and Major Daniel Dwyer, helped draft a new study issued by the American Enterprise Institute that called for sending an additional 4 or 5 combat brigades, or some 14,000 to 17,500 troops, to Baghdad. In its recently released report, the bipartisan Iraq Study Group rejected the idea of a substantial force increase on the order of 100,000 to 200,000 troops, saying that those levels were not available for sustained deployment and would feed fears in Iraq that the United States was planning a long-term occupation. The U.S. commander in Iraq determines that such steps should be effective. We could, however, they say, support a short-term redeployment or a surge of American combat forces to stabilize Baghdad. And you've tuned to the news here on Radio Havana, Cuba for this Monday evening. Gunmen in Iraqi army uniforms burst into Red Crescent offices on Sunday in Baghdad and kidnapped about 24 employees and visitors at the humanitarian organization. In this latest violence, gunmen in 5 pickup trucks pulled up to the office of the Iraqi Red Crescent in downtown Baghdad and abducted 20 to 30 employees and visitors. A Red Crescent official who spoke on condition of anonymity because of concern for his own safety said the gunmen left women behind. The Red Crescent, which is part of the International Red Cross movement, has around 1,000 staff and some 200,000 volunteers in Iraq. It works closely with the International Committee of the Red Cross, which visits detainees and tries to provide food, water, and medicine to Iraqis. Mahsin Abdelaha, the Secretary General of the Iraqi Red Crescent, appealed to the kidnappers to release the captives. He said that they represent a humanitarian agency that works for the general good, and that this agency, the Red Crescent, helps all people, regardless of their religious sect. At least a dozen or a half dozen mass kidnappings have been carried out in the Iraqi capital so far this year. Many believe they are carried out by armed groups linked to the sectarian violence between Sunnis and Shiites. The abduction comes just days after the vice president of the organization, Dr. Hamal al-Korori, said that American occupation forces represented a greater threat and a greater danger to its work than insurgents. On Friday, he said that the insurgents are Iraqis, a lot of them Iraqis, and they respect the Iraqis. They respect the Red Crescent's identity, which is neutrality. In response, Lieutenant Colonel Christopher Garver, a U.S. military spokesman in Baghdad, said that the U.S.-led occupation forces strive to ensure that they are respectful when they conduct interaction with the local population. The George W. Bush administration has asked an appeals court in Washington to overrule a federal judge and allow the White House to keep records or keep secret any records of visitors to Vice President Dick Cheney's office and his residence. To make the visitor records public would be, quote, an unprecedented intrusion into the daily operations of the vice presidency, according to a 57-page brief from the Justice Department to the U.S. Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia. The government was responding to an October order by U.S. District Judge Ricardo Urbina to release 2 years of White House visitor logs to the Washington Post. The newspaper, researching the access lobbyists and others have had to the White House, sought Secret Service records for anyone visiting Cheney, his legal counsel, chief spokesman, and other top aides and advisors. In his ruling, Judge Urbina requested that the government's primary argument against releasing the records that the logs are protected by Cheney's right to executive privilege. The government's response was twofold, largely focusing on the ownership of the records. Attorneys for the Justice Department called the judge's decision flatly inconsistent with his ruling, acknowledging that the Secret Service had only limited and temporary control over the visitor logs. Since the records are ultimately controlled by the Vice President's office, the Secret Service is not authorized to release them, according to the U.S. Department of Justice. Those are some of the stories we're following for you here on Radio Havana, Cuba. Once again, our headlines. Military options sought for up to 50,000 more troops in Iraq. The Iraqi government troops burst into Red Crescent offices, kidnapping 30. And the White House wants to protect Vice President Dick Cheney. Keep it locked in to Radio Havana, Cuba. We'll be back with more news in about 20 minutes. If you'd like to see us on the international web, it's www.radiohc.cu. I'm Ed Newman from Radio Havana, Cuba's news desk.
And now, for a further look at some of the stories making news here in Cuba, I'm Celsi Presnell. A U.S. congressional delegation headed by Massachusetts Democrat Bill Delahunt and Arizona Republican Jeff Flake wound up a three-day visit to the island on Sunday with a call to end Washington's irrational blockade against Cuba. During a press conference at Havana's Hotel Nacional, Arizona Republican Jeff Flake said that everyone will soon witness a transition in Washington. In early January, said Flake, the Senate and the House of Representatives will have a new majority party. He stressed that there will be a number of hearings on issues which will range from drug trafficking to the elimination of travel restrictions. The Republican from Arizona said he believes the travel restrictions to Cuba must be eliminated because there is no moral basis for such a policy, given the focus and emphasis of family values that are so dear for the American and Cuban people. At a news conference Sunday, the bipartisan group, made up of 4 Republicans and 6 Democrats, took turns making statements that agreed on the need to lift the ban on travel to Cuba and the restrictions currently pending on the remittances made by Cuban Americans to their relatives in the island. Greg Meeks, a Democrat from New York, said what he learned on this visit is that the U.S. foreign policy must change not only concerning Iraq, but also regarding a neighbor only 90 miles away, on which we have imposed crude restrictions for almost half a century and to no effect. A Republican representative from Missouri, Joanne Emerson, said that both sides should have two-way commercial trade which would benefit both the United States and Cuban economies. However, Emerson said that the U.S. Treasury Department has created more restrictions to make it even more difficult for the Cuban government to buy U.S. agricultural products. She noted that it is important that the transition in Washington makes some changes to make it easier for the Cuban government to purchase U.S. commodities. In reference to White House restrictions and family visits, Hilda Solis, a Democrat from California, said that they want to help the Cuban-American community in the United States who want to be able to freely visit their relatives on the island, as well as lift restrictions for family remittances. Bipartisan congressional group arrived in Cuba on Friday with the objective of beginning a process to change Washington's cruel policy against Cuba. They said that it is in the interest of the United States to change its
48-year-old anti-Cuba policy. During their stay in Havana, the U.S. delegation met with Foreign Minister Felipe Perez Roque, the President of the Cuban Parliament, Ricardo Alarcón, President of the Cuban Central Bank, Francisco Soberón, Director of the island's importing company, Alimport, Pedro Álvarez, and Cardinal Jaime Ortega. A meeting of deputies to the Cuban Parliament heard a report on Monday regarding the progress of housing construction programs in Cuba. Monday's agenda included speeches by top officials from organizations in charge of implementing the plan to improve the housing situation on the island. Representatives from the Labor and Social Security Ministry discussed discipline and working hours, supported by the recent Congress of the Cuban Workers' Confederation, as favorable instruments for boosting productivity. Wednesday and Thursday's agenda includes debate of the 10 permanent working commissions of the legislative body to analyze the labor carried out this year and goals for 2007. Representatives from public health, economy and planning, transportation, tourism, the sugar industry, foreign trade and foreign ministries, and those of the central bank, among others, are attending deliberations of the Cuban Parliament, also known as the National Assembly of People's Power, meeting this week here in Havana. The 7th Cuban University Students Federation FEU Congress begins sessions on Monday with the participation of almost 800 delegate students from all over the island. The Congress runs through Wednesday, December 20th. Today, the Cuban University students met with Education and Health Public Ministers and the President of the National Institute of Sports and Recreation. They discussed topics related to each area and analyzed the education revolution in Cuba. Particular emphasis was placed on the main principle of the expansion of the university, which allows the creation of centers in all municipalities of the country. Another topic discussed during the FEU Congress is the social vocation of the universities and their participation in the energy revolution on the island. Students are also discussing the role of FEU as president of the Latin American and Caribbean Continental Organization, as well as tasks of that regional student organization. And that's a look at some of the stories making news here in Cuba. For this, Monday, December 18th, in Havana, I'm Sergio Pérez.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba, and I'm Isabel Garcia. Up next, our editorial viewpoint.
The suffering is not yet over for residents of the U.S. city of New Orleans, which was devastated by Hurricane Katrina in 2005. Once the tropical storm left U.S. territory behind, the count began on dead bodies, nearly 1,500 hurricane victims in the flooded areas, which totaled 80% of New Orleans, also known as the City of Jazz. A year and a half later, the wounds are still open. Government aid is virtually nilled and limited to the so-called dry areas, the least affected by the heavy flooding and inhabited by the city's white, well-off minority. Meanwhile, inequalities prevailed in New Orleans, just as when the hurricane warning was issued. On that occasion, the wealthy few left the city in their cars, while the majority poor were abandoned to their fates by a government clearly more interested in colonizing Iraq than in saving the lives of hundreds of thousands of U.S. citizens in the state of Louisiana. However, Washington hurried hand out contracts to big U.S. companies for the task of reconstructing New Orleans, the same companies that pocketed hundreds of millions of dollars even though they failed to do the job in Iraq. In the Arab country, it took them 3 years to restore essential services, and analysts charge that history is repeating itself, now in the very U.S. city. The truth is that New Orleans has registered significant demographic change, which some call ethnic cleansing, with nearly 200,000 residents, mostly poor blacks, homeless, an expert, saying that the city is still vulnerable to similar devastating flooding, while the federal government remained with their arms crossed. New Orleans residents choose to forget their misfortune for a moment, trying to recall the joy of the days of jazz music and carnival, though the melancholic notes of the saxophone inevitably bring him back to the tragic present and uncertain future. In Havana, I'm Lena Valverde.
Up next, we have the report on the defense speech of one of the five Cuban political prisoners incarcerated in the United States, Ramon Lavagnino.